Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on January 9th, 2018. This is the Week 2 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study, based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on Shamatha Vipassana Meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So week one, Shamatha Vipassana meditation. I'm not going to talk that long, at least I don't think I will, because I'd like to hear, and I have a specific question for all of you. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. But let me start with a quote from the Buddha that you all read this past week, at least those that are reading the book. Whatever is to be done by a teacher with compassion for the welfare of students, that has been done by me out of compassion for you. Here are the roots of trees. Here are empty places. Go and meditate. Don't be lazy. Don't become one who is later remorseful. This is my instruction to you. And he said basically the same thing throughout his life. He said basically the same thing, these same words, almost, were the last words he ever spoke. The importance of meditation, as the Buddha taught meditation, can't be overstated. But what is most important is to understand that the Buddha taught a very simple meditation method for a very specific purpose. Meditation was something that had been around. It wasn't something that the Buddha discovered. In fact, he studied two different very popular meditation techniques and rejected both of them as not leading to his goal, which was understanding the nature of suffering. Nobody really knows when human beings first started meditating, but it was probably at least 500, maybe even 1,000 years before the Buddha used meditation as part of his path to awakening. And again, awakening means gaining full human maturity, truly understanding the nature of things in the phenomenal world. The Buddha taught meditation primarily for deepening concentration, not for having experiences, and not so much for even gaining any type of insight during meditation, except, but that will certainly arise. But the point of meditation is to deepen concentration. And the reason why I keep saying that over and over again is it helps not getting frustrated with our practice if we remember what the goal is. And so every time we find that we're caught up in our thinking again during meditation, we find that we're caught up in the arising and the passing away of feelings and thoughts, rather than being mindful of the arising and the passing away of our breath. When we do that, we're furthering a distracted mind. But every time that we recognize that we're caught up in our thinking again and return our mindfulness to our breathing, to our in-breath and our out-breath, we're deepening concentration. So you could almost say that the purpose of, or the point of meditation, is not to be mindful of your breath, but it's to be mindful of your distracted thinking, isn't it? Again, every time that you catch yourself, that you're caught up in your thinking, that you notice that you're distracted by feelings or thoughts or a combination of the two, and come back to the sensation of breathing, you're deepening concentration. And you're interrupting the primary problem, which is a conditioned mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so that is the reason why the Buddha said, go find the root of a tree or an empty hut. Because he knew the singular importance of interrupting a mind that is continually distracted by its own wrong views of self. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
We're done. Let's go home. it really is that simple. So then why didn't the Buddha just teach to go meditate? Why didn't he just say that and say you're all good to go? Go find the root of a tree in an empty hut. Because there's a lot more to it than just that. Because of the nature of conditioned mind, we need a framework for recognizing how that conditioned mind affects us in an ongoing basis. Mm-hmm. And so it's within the framework of an Eightfold Path that we're able to recognize the conditioned state of our mind and where those changes need to be made. Where we utilize the concentration that we've developed in meditation and the refined mindfulness of integrating the Eightfold Path in its most effective way. And what is its most effective way? To understand and gain insight into the impermanence of all things, the not-self-characteristic anatta, meaning, as the Buddha used the term, the views that you've developed about yourself do not constitute a self. They're wrong views. Let go of the views. That's really the sole reason why the Buddha used that term, anatta. Anatta was a common word during the Buddha's time, but the Buddha used it in an uncommon way. He used the word because it was common to make the point about the difference between what he was teaching and the common teachings of his day. And you could say that's still true today. And then, lacking an understanding of the impermanence of all things and what truly constitutes a self, dukkha arises. So impermanence, the not-self-characteristic, and resulting dukkha. Those are the three marks of existence. That is what we are to gain insight into with a proper meditation practice within the proper framework of the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that lead to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointment, suffering, dukkha. Then his very first teaching, you ever hear me say this before? Then his very first teaching was the Four Noble Truths, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And then everything the Buddha would teach for the next 45 years of his teaching career was in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, everything. You cannot find a sutta that the Buddha ever gave that is out of that context. In fact, it really is the only way to understand the Buddha's teachings is to understand the overall context that he taught that in. And so meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation, is taught to deepen concentration and in a overarching way to support understanding Four Noble Truths, that dukkha occurs. Why is it so important? Let me put that another way. Why is something so obvious as dukkha occurring a noble truth, and why does it take a well-concentrated mind to understand it as a noble truth? Remember, the Buddha said that an awakened mind, from the perspective of right view, has a view that completely understands dukkha at a penetrating level. Why is that?
Are you really asking the question?
Yeah, if you have an answer, because I haven't figured it out yet. No, I'd like...
why is it important?
Yes. Why is understanding dukkha important? And why does it take a well-concentrated mind to do that?
Well, that's two different questions.
Yes.
Understanding suffering would help me understand other people's suffering, would help me to have insight into what's causing the suffering so that I could let go of it.
Yep. Cessation of clinging.
Which would bring about the realization of cessation of, yeah.
Yeah, so there's
the... I don't even know if I answered the second question.
You did.
I forget what the second question was.
You got a gold star, Frank. Thank you.
But also the ego will do anything to sustain itself.
Yes.
So if you understand dukkha, then you understand that the relationship of dukkha to the not self, it masks the effort. And if you can understand it, then you can stop it from occurring.
Another gold star. The
can I
sure.
Isn't it the fact that when you're awakened, there is no dukkha? Because then you understand the world. Then you understand all that you see in life, you smell in life, you taste in life, and whatever. You understand it.
Yep.
And therefore, through the understanding, you understand the dukkha, and by the understanding, there is none, because you understand it.
Yep.
You're not frustrated, you're not... Against it,
another word for understanding or right understanding is right view.
Well, going to say through sitting that you can feel the release of it.
Yes, and that's really where I'm going with all this.
Yeah.
In order to awaken, in order to develop that profound concentration, it's necessary. We have to have the ability to recognize that it's occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Ahepasiko, it's so important.
And recognize the I-making.
And all of it. And that's all part of the process, isn't it, Helen?
Right.
And understanding dukkha, we're understanding ourselves, like Frank said.
Yeah, and when you finally see what the enemy is, you realize it's been you the whole time.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. But really, what the enemy really is, ignorance, wrong views. Again, that's what the Buddha awakened to. And it's, as Liz was saying, it's astonishing the subtle but powerful strategies that we'll create to continue to ignore our own ignorance. You could really say, in the Loka Sutta, where the Buddha is talking about when he first looked out on the world after awakening, he said, the world is a flame. It's a flame with a passion of eye-making. And if you understand suffering on the micro and the macro level, in other words, it's the same thing that causes suffering for me as an individual is the same condition that causes suffering for the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. And the Buddha described that as there's two words I was going to use. These are three common hindrances that we all have: greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. They're all part of one thing, though, aren't they? Aversion is just the other side of the same coin of greed. I want something to be different than it is. In aversion, I want less of something. And ongoing deluded thinking is another... is metaphorical for the simple ongoing ignorance that we're all a part of. It's deluded thinking. So again, how would we know? How does a deluded mind know that it's deluded? How does a mind know that it's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that it's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths? How would it know? It needs a proper framework and a well-concentrated mind. Because a mind that is constantly distracted will never be able to recognize its own ignorance, its own deluded thinking. We'll have no frame reference for it, will it? The four foundations of mindfulness are also called the four frames of reference. We have to have a way to mirror or reference our own thoughts, words, and deeds back to ourselves in a meaningful way, in a way that doesn't allow us to continue our own ignorance and explain away. Maybe I should use another word, and excuse away our own behavior. So how do most of us first begin to get a handle on our behavior, specifically self-referential or behavior rooted in ignorance?
Right speech.
Right speech, right action, and right livelihood. That's why they're there. And this is where what the Buddha talk sometimes gets confused with religion, because all religions, most religions, I should say, have some moral and ethical components of it. And so the Buddha's teaching that we should be moral and ethical people. But the primary reason is when we recognize where we're not acting in virtuous ways, that's where our eye-making is. And when we can learn to recognize that from a well-concentrated mind, we can practice restraint at that moment. And when we've developed the ability to practice restraint, and this is, I'm just talking about the initial ability, not talking about an awakened human being who no longer experiences dukkha. The beginning of the process of awakening begins on our cushions, and it begins with being mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath. And as our concentration increases just slightly, we don't have to have the most profound concentrated mind in order to start developing the Eightfold Path. That little bit of concentration is enough to recognize where I'm not in right speech, right action, or right livelihood. Or where I might not be practicing right effort, meaning putting time in on my cushion and developing the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. That little bit of concentration will serve as a foundation now for our life. We'll know when we're distracted because we have a benchmark. We've developed it in meditation. And it's from that foundation of a well-concentrated mind that will be able to integrate the other important teachings as part of our Dhamma practice. Next week, we're going to get into the four foundations of mindfulness. After that, we go through the Eightfold Path in a very direct way. And then the rest of the things. Dependent origination, the three marks of existence, etc. And we finish, I think, week 9 is karma and rebirth, and then the hindrances. So we're beginning with meditation. And we're putting it in its right place. I'm using meditation to deepen concentration. Next week, when we get into the four foundations of mindfulness, you'll be reminded again about why the Buddha teaches to be mindful of the breath in the body, feelings arising, passing away, thoughts arising, passing away, and finally the present quality of mind. We need a well-concentrated mind in order to even begin that process. So that's enough on Shamatha Vipassana meditation and why we do it. What I'd like to hear is those of you that have been coming for a while, how your meditation has increased, how your concentration has increased, and if you're comfortable about talking how long you're meditating. If you don't want to, that's fine too. It can be kind of personal. And how you see meditation fit into the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. So that'd be a good part of our discussion, and we'll start with Helen. Good to see you today.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Wonderful to be here with everyone and meet our new returning members.
Yeah.
My meditation is going well. During my busy work season, my morning meditation is usually about 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this morning, I for the first time, I actually used your prompts for meditation, and I meditated for 20 minutes.
Oh, good.
One thing that I do to catch myself when one thought is clinging to another thought, is when I notice it, I just put a little smile on my face, like, gotcha, and then it's, you know, being kind and gentle to myself, and then I go right back to my breathing, and so that's kind of how I transition back into it, and that seems to work for me. And just a comment on what you opened with, the quote from the Buddha, and there was something in there about living a life without remorse.
Yeah.
I think. And it's just so clear that if you follow the Eightfold Path, you are living a life without remorse.
Yeah.
You know, there's your playbook for living a life without remorse. And
yeah,
it's such a gift. You know? And it's you know, all that easy and all that hard, but I find that the more that I meditate, the more spaciousness there is between those clinging thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And then I allow myself to be gentle and come back to it and be compassionate to my human weakness. but it also gives me that pause button throughout my day, too. You know, I just bring that spaciousness into my day and it helps me to reframe any thoughts that aren't quite on the Eightfold Path before they come out of my mouth, and it's just really handy and beneficial.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's entirely practical, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very.
Everything
useful.
You learn, you can use right away.
Yes.
And really, it's a. So how do you see meditation supporting the rest of the Eightfold Path?
It calms it teaches me how to calm my mind, create that spaciousness between thoughts so that I can be more thoughtful in word and action.
Mm-hmm.
And intent. The reward entices me to put even more effort into it. So I am doing more reading and spreading your books around.
Thank you.
Because I see how beneficial it is. So, yeah, just very, very useful.
Thank you. Andrew, good to see you tonight.
Amen. Well, my practice, as I mentioned to you when I came in, has been erratic, and it's been like that ever since I started coming here. But I've gotten to the point where I understand that I go through these periods of time. Sometimes I'm not putting in the right effort that I should.
Yeah.
But I, instead of being upset about it, I simply learn as a result of being in the Sangha is to just understand that it is what it is and smile and then try again.
Yeah.
And that in itself has permeated other aspects of my life when things are getting a little upsetting for some reason. That I've learned now that there is a technique called breathing. And that I say it is what it is, and then I just smile.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes I can't conjure up elements of the Eightfold Path as I'm experiencing things. I can't repeat them to myself, but I know how to do that. I know how to just step away from it and smile. So it's not on a very deep level, I don't think, that I have evolved, but I think I have.
Yeah. I think you have too, Andrew. Those are practical but profound benefits. That's why we do it, to develop a common... Buddha described an awakened human being as having a calm and peaceful mind. Not such a big deal, except most of us can't get that unless we have a way to do it. I think it was Mary said last week, maybe 2 weeks ago, of how important it is to engage in right effort and really put the time in. And I know you and Judy are both really busy. We all are. You know, the more you put into this, the more you get out of it. When we start developing, Helen said this too, when we start feeling the benefits of it or experiencing the benefits of it, that helps us engage even more, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That it really keeps us focused, and we know what the end result is. So.
Yeah.
Glad you're here. Thank you. Tell Judy I said hello and hope her mom's doing better. Christine, welcome. Good to see you again. How was your meditation tonight?
It was good. I'm getting over a cold. I'm a little tired, but it was good.
Well, I'm glad you made it. I hope you can continue to join us. If you are, we're going through the book, The Truth of Happiness. I think there's a copy or two out there. And the homework will be the third chapter. And we'll come back and talk about it. If you're just reinvigorating a practice, I say this all the time, just start with short periods of meditation, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, and if you can do that twice a day, and then be part of our Sangha again, it'd be great to have you. I'm glad you're here tonight.
John, is the homework the second or the third chapter for next week?
Second chapter. What did I say?
You said third.
Yeah, thank you.
We always go through
that. Yeah. Four foundations of mindfulness.
So always read two. The one you think you should and that one you think maybe you should.
The slightly embellished meditation instruction relates to something called the Anapanasati Sutta, and we went through that sutta over about 6 weeks. It would be a good idea to spend some time rereading it. You know, it's a very important sutta, and it relates to this important. We will be going over that again too soon. Keila, good to see you again. What a nice surprise. How has your meditation been going?
Well, now that I hear there's homework, I'm leaving. No, it's really been good. And I look forward to expanding through your teachings. And sounds like we're among a group of teachers here. So,
yeah.
I feel blessed.
Yeah. Again, great to see you. Please tell Lady I said hello.
I hope
to see you soon.
Hopefully next week.
Good. Good. Mary, good to see you. There's nobody behind you.
What are the questions again? What am I asking?
What are you doing here?
I am learning about equanimity and having a calm and peaceful mind. I think you also were asking, learning that Everything is on the in-breath and the out-breath. Life is the in-breath and the out-breath. The suffering is the arising within you, realizing the release when it exits. Learning to be able to do that off your cushion. And being very mindful of the Eightfold Path and carrying that with you as you experience things that cause an arising of suffering within you, so you can recognize it immediately and let it go, and you know, maintain right view, and then therefore in every moment maintain your intention to awaken.
Thank you. Yeah, well, one of the questions was how meditation supports the integration of the Eightfold Path, and you explained that beautifully. Thank you.
And I am meditating most days, twice a day, for 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
A couple times I've missed, you know, one or the other, but for most days I'm getting both in.
That's great. Thank you. David, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. My practice is going very well. Twice a day, 20 minutes a day. I tried to meditate in the past. It was disastrous. Couldn't concentrate, couldn't sit, didn't know I was doing it. I think I wanted to be a better person, better husband, better father. There was no, like I said last week, there was no context to any of it. And this time around, I wasn't meditating, I was just reading and listening. And then when I started meditating, I jumped right into the 20 minutes twice a day because there was context. I understood the whole path and I saw it as a framework. So it made, hey, I got to breathe. That's the easy part. I'm breathing all the time anyways. That's easy. But then with the Anapanasati Sutta, that gave me more context to what the whole point of it was, is to be aware of when your distractions are arising. And that clarified a lot for me.
Thank you, David. It really is remarkable when we put the time in and have the right context. For many, many years, I had no context, but I was meditating. I did 7 and 10 day sesshins, which is sitting in meditation for 12 to 14 hours a day with some breaks. And it's just brutal, especially without having a context. And because so many other people were basically doing the same thing, I figured I must be doing something wrong, or I'm just not a good meditator. And that's often how it's presented to you. Mm-hmm. You just do it long enough, hard enough, and eventually you'll have these breakthroughs. Never happened to me, and I can't imagine. Well, I know a lot of people that were long-term and long-time meditators and never really got anywhere because they didn't have the right framework. And if you think about a mind that is rooted in ignorance and it is distracted by its own thoughts, and you tell that mind to go sit quietly, what's going to happen? It's just going to run away with itself. And that is just what happens, and that's what the Buddha recognized. We need a proper context. We need a framework. We need a focus, the in-breath and the out-breath. And in that way, we can develop profound concentration and integrate the Eightfold Path. Thank you. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. It's good to be here. You know, tonight's a really good reminder of the way that the soul folds in and out and back onto itself, and that the meditation feeds the clarity, feeds the equanimity, feeds the integration, and that, you know, even when the times are difficult to sit and meditate, once you understand how one thing feeds the other, then it makes the sitting easier to do. And so I was doing some traveling, and I was able to sit and meditate some, but not what I would call really consistent. But in the afterglow of sitting and meditating before I left, I was able to use restraint, great speech. I developed a pretty good attitude for how I was, my intentions for where I was traveling to, who I was spending time with. So the traveling ended up being a really good experience. So it's just, for me right now, it's a matter of getting back into a consistent practice and starting to intellectually, I know that the benefits will come, but to actually do the sitting and then to actually integrate the benefits is what I need to do. So it's a good reminder of the whole flow of how this works.
I agree. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. Thank you. It's such an open question. We don't know where to start to answer it. But I meditate for 30 minutes twice a day. And generally, I find that my morning meditations, my mind is more quiet than the evening meditation. So therefore, I find the morning meditations more pleasant, although being pleasant isn't the point of doing it, but just being easier, the sort of more pleasant, and I have to sort of battle the way through the second one through the day. You know, my mind is just sometimes just hard to settle my mind down and later in the day. I think the main thing that, well, there's lots of things you get out of meditation, but the main thing I see in my meditation mind is anatta. Mm-hmm. How often my mind will wander off in a story of no consequence, meaning nothing, complete waste of time, but it just wanders, it just wants to do it. It just like a wild horse, you know, it just takes on taming. So often after my meditation and I reflect back on my meditation, that's often what I think about, just how insistent your anatta mind is when I think about it. What I've been experiencing, and I don't know where I'm coming from saying this, but I hope it makes sense to you anyway. I think, here we go.
First problem.
What I'm experiencing in my mind is that if happiness is the extreme to the right and sadness is the extreme to the left, I'm not getting those extremes like I used to do.
Yeah.
My feelings and thoughts are going more midstream, and in a funny sort of a way, there's a bit of a muzziness between them. And I can see a connection between being happy and being very sad. They're not. If I was happy, I was happier. I never thought of being sad and happy at the same time. I was happy, and if I was sad, I was sad. There was no extreme from that. But now there's kind of a link between happiness and sadness to happiness, and in between the extreme right and left, everything's getting a little bit muzzy. And that's kind of happening. I can't explain it.
Yes, you are.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you're describing a mind that is developing equanimity. Equanimity means a balanced mind. It's just that way. And when you understand thoughts and feelings and emotions, a movement in the mind is a movement in the mind. You know, happiness or sadness—it's the mind blowing this way and that way. It's when we insist that I need to be happy, or some people relish their sadness. When we start creating identities, that there's a problem there, isn't it? But as our minds begin to calm and we're not reacting to the dukkha in the world, then it's just what's occurring. We're able to stay mindfully present. That's the essence of concentration and refined mindfulness, is to be able to see things as they are, to experience life as it occurs, without the need for it to be any different than it is. And of course, it doesn't mean when something awful happens that we laugh about it. We gain the ability to be appropriately responsive to life as it occurs. And so then all of life has meaning to it. It's not just, you know, the once a week when we get that piece of chocolate cake. Everything has meaning. And it should. When you really understand just the opportunity to awaken, that's remarkable enough, isn't it? That's enough reason to get out of bed in the morning. I got an opportunity to awaken here. All of us do. It's remarkable. Thank you. Frank, good to see you.
Good to be here tonight. Hello to everybody. My practice is good. Everything that Horna said.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, I set my alarm clock every morning for 4:30, and I usually sit from 4:30 to 5:30. But I'm like usually ranging from 30 to 45 minutes in meditation in the morning, and then I'll read for 15 minutes, maybe contemplate on something, on impermanence. But pretty much the practice is great. What were some of the questions I've answered?
Is your practice great?
I think what's been like remarkable to me, what I can see, is how I can be present with whatever's occurring throughout the day. I used to daydream a lot. Like I would have a problem with like that mind, that wandering mind, for no reason, just because that's what it's like to do. And I do notice it sometimes in meditation, but I use that as the practice of mindfulness, of just the quality, seeing the quality of mind, returning to the breath. And I've been noticing that I'm focusing more on the out-breath than before. Like, I used to focus on the in-breath a lot, not remembering the out-breath, but now I'm noticing the out-breath. And what Lorna was saying about like the sadness, the happiness, more like the movements towards craving or aversion, and how that's just how life is. Like before, I think I would just self-identify with things that made me feel like I was gaining something or causing happiness, and now I don't identify with the sadness or the happiness, more like in the middle. You know, and it creates more of a balanced, like, emotional stability. Yeah. I don't feel those large movements of rage or, like, I used to really beat myself up a lot. You know, negative talk.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't really notice that happening anymore. I don't have negative talk. And I think as I, like, in the second chapter, mindfulness, you talk about transcending dukkha. And I think that's what's happening. What I'm noticing is that my relationship to the dukkha or the suffering or the pain or whatever is going on has changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. And since that has changed, my relationship with everyone else has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter how somebody else responds to me or reacts to me. I still have internal joy that I don't really have to worry about somebody else. I don't care. Like, I mean, I care, but I don't
know. Yeah. From letting go of self-referential views, you don't take things personally anymore.
Well,
because you're not doing it to yourself. You know?
I notice how quick it can happen in the day. How quickly I can attach myself / clinging to something that, like, I have a mind that seeks outwardly to soothe its mood, you know, moods, and now it's more like I'm relying on an internal presence. to soothe my mood.
Yeah.
If I'm in a mood.
And you're able to get out of it that quickly, too. Again, it's not taking things personally. The, I think you're noticing how remarkable it is to have some concentration. When we start developing it, we learn to appreciate it. That, yes, I can actually think something now. I have gained control of my thoughts, at Vitakka Santana Sutta. We gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. And that's what you're describing. So. Thank you. And it's really remarkable as a Sangha how we've all developed meditation. Some of us have meditated for longer periods of time than others. And that's really, it's not a, there's no goal in meditation. In other words, if you gradually work your way up to 20 minutes or 30 minutes, that's great. But it doesn't mean you're not doing it if you're only at 15 minutes. But what I'd like to say, all of you started with short periods of meditation, correct?
Yeah.
We all do, with 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, and gradually add some time.
And I'll have to add it, but even when I'm busy, if I get 10 minutes, I'll break it up into like 3 or 4 different sections throughout the entire day. If I can get 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever, I can get a break. You know, if I'm waiting for someone and I'm in the car, I'll do that.
Yeah,
I'll hit that on and I'll just meditate for 5 minutes. Wherever I can grab 5 minutes.
Yeah, and it's effective. A couple of years ago, if somebody told you to go meditate, you would have said, you're crazy. I don't have time for it. I can't do it. And now I'm putting words in your mouth. I don't think it's anything you want to do without, is it?
No, but there's something that's weird that happens to me when I'm in a bar with maybe somebody else and they turn the music up. I don't know what it is. I can only listen to music when I'm by myself.
Yeah.
It's really strange. I don't know why. But
it is.
I'm still out on that. I don't understand what's going on.
Maybe you'd just rather not be, if you're with other people, maybe you'd just rather be with people rather than being distracted
by
music.
Maybe a conversation going on and the music's up kind of loud and I can't hear the conversation and the music at the same time.
Yeah.
And I'm like focusing on one thing. I don't know. It's kind of weird.
No, but that
I have lessened my multitasking a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something else.
It frustrates people mm-hmm. around me sometimes, but I really have, right now I'm making the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, then I'll do this.
Because
and then I'll do the dishes mm-hmm. and then I'll do something, you know, in my studio. I mean, I just try to say right now I'm doing this task.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, that's what it is. It's like, we're listening to music, then we're listening to music. If somebody wants to talk, then I'll turn the music off and I'll listen.
Yeah.
Look at the sensitivity to the distractions.
Yeah.
Yeah, you notice that you're no longer mindfully present because there's too much going on.
When I was 7, I got a little book of sayings, and one of them was,
whatever's worth doing is worth doing well. It might be important, you never can tell.
Whose book was that?
One thing at a time, and that done well, is a very good rule, as many can tell.
That's great. And that's another, it's the essence of a well-concentrated mind, to be able to stay focused.
We're sisters, so it's the same family.
It's not weird. Just for the new people.
Well, it's,
in case anyone was thinking that was really weird.
It's a little weird, but...
We have clairvoyance as well. We'll be levitating later.
We're sisters here. So.
The three of you?
Yes.
Wow.
There's 2 more sisters.
Yeah, I was going to say there's more to it than just that. Eric, how are you tonight? Good to see you. I'm good. Thank you for asking. How is your practice going?
Let's see. It's going good. It's not as much as I should be doing, but it's a work in progress.
Good. It is, for all of us. So watch that. Be careful when you're shooting on yourself. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Be very, very gentle with yourself. I say this all the time. Recognize when you could put in a little bit more effort, but leave it there. You know, just start with short periods of meditation. You're coming to our classes. You're reading the book. It takes a little while, but nobody here, I don't think, had a meditation practice, maybe Keela, before you came
right.
here.
Right. But also, you go in, it fluctuates sometimes, depending on what's happening in your life.
Yep.
And sometimes you just sort of,
flow.
Yeah, you fall off from doing it. And what I recognize is the conditioned mind sort of starts creeping back in.
Yeah.
And then you can just, that's the beauty of it, is that you just, sort of forgive yourself for not having spent the time and taken the right action or the right effort to sit and meditate and just start over again. So
let's start over.
It's always a beginner's mind. It's always,
That's a good mindfulness teaching, though. Be mindful that you're not really having progress.
Right.
Exactly.
And
so also to remember
that that's happening.
There's no such thing as an advanced meditator, but there are people that have developed a meditation practice. But there's no levels, there's nothing else to learn besides what you've learned. But I like what David said, though. As we find the right framework, meditation itself becomes a whole lot easier.
Right.
And it becomes a whole lot more purposeful because we're recognizing the benefits of it. Almost immediately, when you have the right meditation practice within the right framework, very, very quickly, maybe even within the first couple of sessions, you'll recognize that it's having some benefit. And then as you continue to be part of a Sangha, which is, the Buddha didn't teach just to meditate. He taught an eightfold path, but he also taught the importance of being part of a Sangha. And he said that over and over again. We can't do it alone. And I don't, I've known a lot of people. I've been around the Buddhist game for a long time. I don't know anybody that was able to develop I guess I wouldn't know if they were completely isolated, but I don't know anybody that was able to develop a practice completely isolated. I know how much I get out of being part of a Sangha, and most of us say the same thing. We're so glad we have this, what's developed here in Princeton, to have the support. Pardon me?
It's cool to come and talk with like-minded people who are, have the same goal. If I try to talk like this with people at work, they're like,
yeah, or worse. Imagine somebody walking up to someone and saying, "I want to talk to you about my meditation practice."
Yeah.
What?
Not on my phone.
Let's put some music on.
I just want to say it was a couple of weeks ago that Mary spoke very eloquently about right effort.
Yeah.
And it really dawned on me when I began, I looked forward to coming to meditation, and I would come to meditation and I would learn something and I would benefit from being in the Sangha, and then I would go away, and then a week later I'd come back and I'd have the benefit of being in the Sangha. But it's really when you go to the next step and you really do the reading and you really do the discernment of the little delicate differences that make it all come together, that's when you have that wow moment. So it was maybe 2 weeks ago on a Tuesday or so, maybe three, but if you
have the day after Christmas.
Was it? Because I think I was here. It was either the very end of December or early January, so if you fast forward to like the last 45 minutes of the session, that's usually when the discussions go on, and there were some really good things going on that night. And then the other one is August 26th. That's when Matt was talking about the hoodie story.
August 26th.
It's hysterical. You crack up.
They're all. Thank you, Helen. They're. That's in the what has developed here. It really is remarkable. I think you were referring to that, the 3 weeks, the three classes that we had on summarizing the year.
Yes.
So that was between Christmas and New Year's, and it really was is remarkable what's developed and what Mary was. The right effort points us in that direction. That's why it's there. To put the effort in, and as a Buddha would often say, it even says it's there. That don't have remorse. They don't wish you could have done it. Don't have a day that, I wish I could have meditated today. We can meditate every day. Yes.
I really found, as a fairly new person, that when you went over the seven factors, and that seems in many ways just dovetailed to the hindrances.
They do, yeah.
And it just allowed me to, like, be gentle, but recognize, you know, hey, this is a hindrance, but there's answers. Mm-hmm. You know,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Energy, investigation. So for a new person, that it allowed me to kind of put structure to it, and that might be helpful for any new person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. That's referenced in a few suttas, but the Anapanasati Sutta talks about the seven factors of awakening and the hindrances. And the Satipatthana, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, also references that. And in that context, it's taught that these are the things that we should hold in mind. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. And so the Buddha's teaching to first develop a well-concentrated mind, so that you're able to hold in mind the factors of awakening and the five hindrances. So you, when they come up, when you're feeling doubt or skepticism, or you're just tired, you recognize it as a common hindrance. It's something that everybody has to go through. So you treat yourself with great gentleness and compassion, like the Buddha started this out with. If it wasn't compassion, I wouldn't do it. You know? That's why I spent the last 45 years being the most compassionate human being we've ever seen. Because he took the time to teach the Dhamma. And we're doing that with each other, so it's great. Any other questions or comments? So we'll read the second chapter on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and we'll discuss that next week. I will have the next retreat is May 17th to the 20th, and I'll have the registration up by the middle of next week, not any later. I think that's it. Right. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure heart in one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class, and for the five folks online, too. Peace.
Nice.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.